Okay, so today we're going deep on something pretty fundamental to American history, and that is the Black Church in America.
Right.
And the jumping off point for this is a really amazing lecture by Dr. Roger Green that you shared. It's on American Christianity,
Yes.
and it covers so much ground. But what we're going to focus on is kind of pulling out the story of how the Black Church began,
Okay.
and then looking at the different denominations that emerged from that and the roles they played in Black communities.
Sounds good.
So yeah, let's unpack all of that.
So I think a good place to start is by looking at Methodism. And Dr. Green kind of foregrounds the story of Richard Allen in Philadelphia, starting with the Bethel Church in 1793.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Now, the thing to remember about Bethel is it didn't start out as a separate denomination.
Right.
It was a place for Black Methodists to worship within the existing Methodist Episcopal Church.
Okay, so a community forming within the bigger Methodist framework. But that didn't last because it seems like by 1814, Bethel and other Black Methodist churches in Philadelphia decided to go their own way.
Right. Yeah. 1814 is when the African Methodist Episcopal Church, or AME Church, is established.
Okay.
And Richard Allen becomes a bishop in this new denomination. And actually, it's really interesting. Francis Asbury, who was a major figure in early American Methodism, he gave his blessing to this emergence of Black Methodist leadership.
Wow.
So, this act of creating their own denomination, it wasn't just about religious practice. It was like a powerful declaration of self-determination in a society that denied Black people so much agency.
Absolutely. And the AME Church, their impact went way beyond just, Sunday service. They really achieved some pretty amazing things in those early years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
One that really stands out is they established the first Black magazine in America.
Wow.
Just think about the importance of having your own voice, your own platform to share information and perspectives when mainstream society is largely ignoring you. And then also in 1856, they founded Wilberforce University in Ohio.
Wow.
I mean, just imagine the audacity and the foresight to establish a university run by Black people in the mid-19th century. It's really a testament to their commitment to upliftment.
That's incredible. And to think Wilberforce is still going strong today. It's run by the AME Church.
Yes.
I think there are like 450 students.
Yeah, about that.
What do you think it is about those early Black educational institutions that made them so important, and why are they still important today?
Well, I think it just shows a really deep commitment to education within the Black community, recognizing it as a way to progress and to empower themselves in the face of so many obstacles. These institutions, they weren't just about academics, they were about building a future. And just to be clear, the AME Church, it's not just another church. It's like a distinct branch of the Methodist family. This desire for autonomy, for self-governance, is something we're going to see throughout this whole story.
Okay, so that's the AME Church kind of getting off the ground.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, or AME Zion.
Yeah.
And this one comes about a little bit later in 1821, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And there's some similarities with how the AME Church started. James Varick, who's a key Black leader in New York,
Okay.
he founded the Zion Church in 1801.
Okay.
Now, initially, this was also a Methodist Episcopal Church, but the congregation was predominantly Black,
Okay.
while the ministers were white.
Oh, so you've got Black congregants, but white leadership in the pulpit.
Right. And
So that
so,
seems like it would create some tension.
yeah, it did. And Black leaders in New York, led by James Varick, they decided that they needed their own denomination,
Okay.
one with Black leadership at its core.
Makes sense.
So in 1821, the AME Zion Church was formed,
Okay.
and James Varick became its first bishop. And again, this desire for self-governance and Black leadership, even within these established religious frameworks, it's a recurring theme.
Yeah, what's interesting is that Dr. Green points out that this wasn't like a direct conflict with the AME Church,
Right.
which was more in Pennsylvania and Maryland at that time.
Yeah.
It seems like there were different regional needs being met.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It seems like the AME Zion Church was really about establishing a strong Methodist presence and ministry in New York City
Okay.
and expanding from there.
Okay.
So it's not so much about, theological disagreements with the AME Church. It's more about geography and leadership.
Okay. And the AME Zion Church, they also experienced quite a bit of growth, much like the AME Church. What do you think accounts for that kind of rapid expansion?
Well, I think it goes back to that same core desire,
Okay.
to have a religious institution that really understands and represents the Black community,
Yeah.
and that's led by their own people. You know, by 1900, they had a membership of around 350,000, which is pretty significant.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got these two major African Methodist Episcopal denominations kind of coming up in the pre-Civil War period.
Right.
And then Dr. Green talks about some interesting developments that happened within Methodism after the Civil War.
Yeah.
What were some of the shifts that we see happening then?
Well, what's interesting is how the existing Methodist structures react to the changes in society after the Civil War.
Okay.
So in 1870, the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church is formed in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually facilitated by the Methodist Episcopal Church in the South.
Wow.
You know, they recognized that their Black members really wanted their own denomination.
So it's like an acknowledgement of the need for complete self-determination within the Black religious sphere, like a recognition that separate is actually the way forward for genuine spiritual and communal growth.
Exactly. And then in the North, there's a different but equally significant development that happens within the Methodist Episcopal Church.
Okay.
Black members who didn't join the AME churches.
Okay.
They still wanted to remain part of the Methodist structure.
Right.
But they wanted their own space within it.
Okay. And this leads to the creation of what's called the Negro Conference of the Northern Methodist Church.
Right.
And the term conference here is really important for understanding how Methodists govern themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Methodist polity, which is basically how the church is organized and governed.
Okay.
The annual conference is a really important decision-making body.
Okay.
So by having their own conference, Black members in the Northern Methodist Church basically created another Methodist denomination specifically for Black Christians.
Even though they technically were still part of the larger Northern Methodist Church.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so that's like four different Methodist denominations that were formed among Black Christians, which really kind of underscores how central Methodism was to the early Black church.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, a question that some people might have is like, were there significant theological differences between these different groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Dr. Green makes it clear that the differences weren't really about core Methodist doctrines.
Okay.
So, you know, like the belief in the Trinity or the understanding of sanctification or the structure of church government with bishops and conferences.
Okay.
It was really about this desire for autonomy and Black leadership.
Mm.
You know, they wanted to be able to worship and govern themselves.
Okay. So not so much doctrinal disagreements, more about who's in charge and how things are run.
Exactly.
Okay. So that clarifies things. Now let's move on to the Baptists.
Right.
Dr. Green mentions that things are a little bit more complicated.
Yeah.
We're talking about Baptist denominations.
Right. It is more complex. And that's partly because of the Baptist principle of the autonomy of each local church.
Okay.
Which naturally leads to a lot of independent congregations.
Right.
But Dr. Green does point out some really important overarching developments.
Okay.
And one of the earliest is the Colored Primitive Baptist Church, which was founded in 1866.
Okay. Now that name Primitive Baptist, it carries a certain significance, doesn't it? Like suggesting a desire to model their church on the earliest Christian traditions?
Right. Exactly. The Primitive Baptist Church already existed.
Okay.
And it was predominantly white, but Black members within those churches often felt marginalized.
Okay.
So they established their own Colored Primitive Baptist Church in 1866.
Okay. So then also in 1866, we see the emergence of the Northern Carolina Black Convention.
Yeah.
Now, this one feels a little bit different because it's more of a state-level organization.
Right.
So how does that work within this Baptist framework of each church being independent?
Yeah, so while individual Baptist churches are self-governing, they often come together in associations and state conventions, not for the purpose of, like, governing each other, but for fellowship and support and cooperation.
Okay.
So in North Carolina, Black Baptists decided to form their own state convention.
Separate from the existing white convention.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, for all practical purposes, this functioned as another Baptist denomination.
Okay.
For Black Christians in that state.
Okay, so a state-level fellowship essentially becoming its own denomination.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay, and then in 1895, there's this really key development. The National Baptist Convention is formed.
Right.
Which is still a huge denomination today.
Yes, it is.
So what was behind this push to kind of unify at a national level?
Well, there was a real desire to bring all these different Black state conventions together.
Including the North Carolina one?
Yes.
Okay.
And the idea was to create a bigger, more powerful collective voice for Black Baptists across the country.
Okay.
And to allow for greater coordination and impact.
Okay, so strength in numbers.
Exactly.
Okay, and then eventually that North Carolina Black Convention, they merged into the National Baptist Convention.
It did.
Okay.
Yeah, so the momentum was really towards national collaboration. And, you know, so the key lasting Baptist denominations that Dr. Green highlights are the Colored Primitive Baptist Church.
Okay.
And then the National Baptist Convention, which is incredibly significant.
Yeah, and both of those are really rooted in this idea of Black-led worship and community.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've kind of traced the origins of these key Methodist and Baptist denominations that make up the Black Church.
Yeah.
But now let's talk about their broader impact. Like, what did these churches actually do?
Yeah.
Dr. Green really highlights some profound contributions that these Black churches made to the Black community and to American society as a whole.
Yeah, and this is where we really see the significance of the Black church.
Okay.
You know, given the terrible disruption of family structures under slavery, the church became the central place of social identification for Black people.
Okay.
It really functioned as a surrogate family,
Wow.
providing that sense of belonging and support and community that was so often denied to them.
So in the face of all that forced separation and instability, the church steps in and kind of creates a new family structure.
Yeah, exactly.
And it wasn't just about emotional and social support.
No.
They also really fostered economic cooperation within these churches.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the AME Churches Magazine and Wilberforce University are great examples of this.
Yeah.
But, you know, they weren't alone.
Okay.
This was a pattern of Black churches supporting Black ministries, businesses, and educational endeavors.
Yeah.
You know, they were building their own infrastructure of support and empowerment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the church also served as a refuge, a
Yes.
safe space from the hostile world.
Absolutely.
Dr. Green talks about his own experience during the civil rights movement, you know, locked doors, hostile crowds outside.
Yeah.
And it really emphasizes the church as a place of safety and spiritual strength.
Yeah, those images are so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, the church provided sanctuary from the racism and the violence of the outside world.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Green also talks about the church as a kind of surrogate for nationality.
Meaning that because Black people were denied full participation and rights in the nation, the church became a place where they could exercise agency, develop their identity, experience a sense of belonging and self-governance.
Exactly. It was a place to participate, to develop leadership skills,
Yeah.
to articulate values and
In a
aspirations.
society that really excluded them from those spheres.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and this connects to the role that the church played in developing leaders within the Black community
Yeah.
because there were very limited opportunities in predominantly white institutions. The church became like the training ground
It did, yeah.
for so many influential figures. I mean, you think about someone like Martin Luther King Jr.,
Yeah.
his leadership skills were honed in the church.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't just about those formal leadership roles. The church also became the main place where Black heritage and culture were cultivated and passed on.
Right. The Black Church was a repository of Black history and traditions and cultural expression.
Yeah.
You know, keeping those things alive across generations.
Yeah, I mean, think about Black Heritage Month that has its roots in the efforts of the Black Church to preserve their heritage.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's this whole idea of a distinct Black religious experience that developed within these churches.
Right.
And Dr. Green breaks this down into some really key elements.
Yeah, so what is the importance of hymns and spirituals?
Okay.
You know, what we call Negro spirituals,
Yeah.
which were this really powerful and distinctive way of interpreting and expressing biblical messages through the experiences of Black people.
Yeah.
It was a whole new form of sacred music, really.
Yeah. And then there's the role of dance in Black worship,
Yes.
which Dr. Green illustrates with that great story from Nigeria
Yeah.
about the, you know, the very embodied and expressive way of connecting with the divine.
Yeah, it really shows a contrast with more restrained forms of worship, you know,
Right.
and emphasizes that kind of full embodiment of faith.
Yeah. And then maybe most fundamentally, there's the development of Black theology,
Yes.
which Dr. Green explains is about interpreting those key biblical themes, salvation, redemption, the kingdom of God,
Right.
through the specific lens of the Black experience in America.
Right. Taking those universal themes
Yeah.
and understanding them through the struggles and the hopes of Black people in America.
Yeah, like the Exodus story becomes super meaningful in that context.
Absolutely. You know, that narrative of liberation from bondage and the search for a promised land,
Yeah.
you know, it resonated so deeply with Black people.
Yeah.
Now, Black theology as a formal academic field didn't really develop until the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
But its roots are definitely in the Black church.
Makes sense. And finally, Dr. Grund highlights another really important contribution, and he draws on the work of Askew and Perard here.
Yeah.
And it's the idea that Black churches played a really key role in preserving the core of the American revivalistic movement.
Right.
How did they do that?
Well, what's fascinating is that in many ways, the Black church maintained these essential elements of revivalism.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even more so than some of the white denominations.
Oh, okay.
And Askew and Perard point to four key aspects of this.
Okay.
One is this sense of divine immediacy.
Okay.
This belief that God is present and active in their lives.
Okay.
Then there's the emphasis on the spontaneity of individual response to the gospel.
Okay.
The importance of personal holiness as an ongoing journey of faith.
Okay.
And then the element of addressing present injustices, speaking out for justice in the world.
So the Black church kept that spirit of revivalism alive,
yeah.
Emphasizing both that individual transformation and the need to work for social justice.
Absolutely.
Okay, now Dr. Grund then goes on to discuss the appeal of sectarian movements within Black communities, particularly after the Civil War.
Yeah.
So what was it about that post-Civil War period that made these movements attractive to some people?
Well, you know, the period after the Civil War was a time of immense disappointment for a lot of Black people.
Yeah.
You know, slavery had officially ended.
Right.
But they still faced so much racism and violence and exclusion.
Yeah.
And not just from society as a whole, but also from the established churches.
Really?
You know, many Black people felt that the churches had failed them.
Yeah.
Or were even complicit in the injustices they faced.
Mm.
So there was this real void,
yeah.
You know, spiritually and socially.
And then into that void come these different sectarian movements offering alternative messages and communities.
Exactly.
Okay. And Dr. Grund focuses on two examples in particular, both of which gained traction in the North.
Yeah.
The first one is the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, which we know as Jehovah's Witnesses today.
Right.
So this group was founded by Charles Taze Russell in 1872 in New York City.
Okay.
And they had a message that really resonated with some Black people.
Yeah. Their emphasis on the end of the world. You know.
Yeah, the apocalyptic vision.
Yeah.
It kind of provided a framework for understanding the suffering and the injustice that people were experiencing.
Right.
It suggested that all of that would be overturned by God's intervention.
Yeah. And they also had this idea of a righteous remnant.
Yeah. The 144,000 true believers.
Right. And that idea of being chosen, you know.
Yeah.
It appealed to people who felt marginalized and excluded.
By society and by the mainstream churches?
Absolutely.
Mm.
You know, this idea that there's this radical break coming.
Yeah.
It was very powerful in that context.
Okay. So then the second movement that Dr. Grund talks about is the Father Divine Keys Mission Movement.
Right.
Led by George Baker, who became known as Father Divine.
Yes.
And this one is pretty unique.
Yeah, it is.
And maybe even a little controversial.
It is. It's a very distinct movement. It started in Philadelphia around 1880.
Okay.
And it's centered around this claim that George Baker was God.
Wow.
You know, who had come to earth.
Okay.
Which is a pretty radical theological statement.
Yeah.
And they also had a strong communal aspect.
Meaning people were living together.
Yeah. Followers often lived together.
Okay. Under Father Divine's authority.
Right. And you know, in a society where Black people face so much discrimination and lacked economic opportunity.
Yeah.
This idea of belonging to a community governed by God, you know?
Wow.
It really appealed to some people.
Yeah, it's like an extreme version of that desire for belonging and community.
It is, yeah.
And, you know, Dr. Grund even mentions that there's still a Father Divine Hotel in Philadelphia.
There is, yeah, near Temple University.
So it's clear that this movement had a lasting impact on some people.
It did.
Despite the unusual nature of its beliefs and even the kind of mystery surrounding Father Divine's death.
Yeah, you know, there's some ambiguity about when and how he died.
Because people believe that he was God.
Exactly.
Wow.
But, you know, it just shows the profound sense of alienation that some Black people felt from both society and the traditional churches.
Yeah, these movements offered something really different.
Yeah, they did. They offered a sense of purpose and belonging and divine favor.
People who felt like they had nowhere else to turn.
Exactly.
Well, this has been an amazing deep dive into the history and the impact of the Black church in America.
It has.
All based on this incredible lecture by Dr. Grund.
Yeah.
So for you listening out there, we've explored the formation of these key denominations within Methodism and Baptism.
Yes.
We've looked at why they were established and what made them distinct.
Right.
We've also examined the many ways that the Black Church contributed to Black communities and to American society as a whole.
Yeah.
You know, from social identity and economic empowerment to leadership development and cultural preservation, and then, of course, the development of Black theology.
Absolutely.
And then we also touched on the appeal of those sectarian movements.
Right.
To folks who felt marginalized by both the nation and the church.
Yeah.
So I guess the big question that comes out of all of this is, you know, given all this history of disenfranchisement,
yeah,
and the powerful ways that the Black church responded, how do those dynamics continue to shape the religious and social landscape today?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I think it's something worth thinking about, you know.
Yeah.
What can we learn from the resilience and the adaptability of the Black church?
Yeah.
How can we apply those lessons to the challenges that we face today?
Yeah, that's something for everyone to kind of ponder on their own.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's it for our deep dive into the Black church in America.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.